is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. So, an interesting question for the day. Jeb Bush, back in 2009, committed voter fraud. It is a crime. It's a third-degree felony in the state of Florida. 5 years in jail for lying on your voter registration form. And Jeb Bush claimed that he was Hispanic. Now, did he do that because his wife is Hispanic? Did he do that because he wanted to shout out to Hispanics who might vote for him? Did he do that because he wanted to mess with the statistics? Did he do that because he was sort of only half paying attention? That seems kind of tough, but in fact, actually what he clicked was Hispanic, not white. Why did he do that? That's one question. But the bigger question is, should he be in jail? Yesterday, you know, I brought this up yesterday. I talked about it briefly. And this had been known for a couple of days, and the Bush campaign, the Jeb Bush campaign, had essentially said nothing. They said nothing about it. They did nothing about it. And they figured it would blow over, you know, no big deal. And then the Democrats in Florida, and you can see a good piece about this over at politicususa.com. .com. The Democrats in Florida started saying, hey, let's put this guy in jail. Let's charge him with voter fraud. Now, you know, the most recent ones that I think were the most high visibility voter fraud cases. Are not necessarily the most recent ones, but the ones that stick in my mind are Mitt Romney bragging when he was running for president that he had committed voter fraud just so that he could vote against Ted Kennedy. He and his wife no longer lived in Massachusetts. He was no longer the governor. They were gone. They had this mansion in California, you know, one of five or six other houses. But they had no home in Massachusetts. One of their sons had a home with an unfinished basement. Now, unfinished means unfinished. There's no place to live in an unfinished basement. Unless you know, kind of like the lifestyle of homeless people or, you know, Skid Row folks or whatever. I mean, it's, you know, if you like sleeping on concrete and peeing in the corner, unfinished basement, fine. But Mitt Romney listed his son's unfinished basement as his residence so that he could vote against Ted Kennedy and then bragged about it. He committed voter fraud. He didn't actually live there. And when you sign that form, you say, I actually, you know, it's a... Nobody ever prosecuted Mitt Romney. I mean, Ann Coulter did the same thing. She put her agent's name as her address as her address. Now, that was a little more understandable. Ann Coulter was concerned about people, you know, I mean, voter registration forms are public records. And she didn't want people to knock on her door. I get that. You know, I'm in the public eye. I'm a registered voter. My address is probably quite easily found. And I understand, you know, wanting to have a little bit of space between yourself and somebody who might not like you coming to knock on your door. And in my case, I'm fortunate I live in a marina, so there's actually security. it's sort of a gated community, although, you know, but whatever. And who knows, maybe Ann does too. I have no idea where Ann Coulter lived. And I don't know what kind of alarm system she had or what kind of, you know, armed ninja squad she has in her front room, but she felt that she had to lie on her voter registration form. We can cut her a little slack. But Jeb Bush, lying on his voter registration form. I mean, here's the question. Are Republicans serious about voter fraud or not? They keep passing these laws that make it harder and harder for people to vote. They knock 300,000 people off the voting rolls in Wisconsin. Chris Kobach, the Secretary of State in Kansas, has put together a database with millions of names on it in, as I recall, over 30 states, in the neighborhood of 30 states, so that those states can knock people off the voting rolls just before the elections, And if you get knocked off the voting rolls before the election, by the way, you show up to vote and they say, oh, your name's not here. But you can vote anyway. Here's a provisional ballot. And most people don't realize it's just a placebo ballot. It's not a it's a real ballot. It looks like a real ballot. It is a real ballot, but it never gets counted. Unless you come back within, it depends on the state, but unless you come back within a day or so of the election, you go to the election office, you present the proper ID, say, yes, I'm me, and you prove that you actually were registered. And then the state has to figure out why they deregistered you. And they may never get around to that. I mean, this is what happened in 2000 when Jeb Bush ordered Katherine Harris to hire a company in Texas to take the Texas felon list and compare it with the Florida registered voter list. Now, Texas is notorious and has been for some time, but particularly over the last 20 years, for arresting black people for all kinds of things, but especially drug offenses. So if you're looking at the Texas felon list, you're looking at an awful lot of black people, and there are some fairly common names that happen in the black community, a legacy of slavery and whatnot. And so when you compare the Texas felon list to the Florida registered voter list, and if you do like Katherine Harris did at the behest of Jeb Bush when he was governor of Florida in 2000, if you say, you know, they don't even have to match exactly. Jim Washington in Texas could be James Q. Washington in Florida. James Q. Washington in Texas could be Jim W. Washington in Florida. Knock them off. And somewhere between 60 and 80,000 African Americans were removed from the voting lists just weeks before the election of 2000, getting George W. Bush within spitting distance of stealing the election. I mean, you know, with the help of the Supreme Court. So Jeb Bush, I mean, he understands voter fraud. This is a guy who used the excuse of voter fraud. Oh, my God, we've got 80,000 black people in this state who are registered to vote, but they're actually felons. And the way we prove it is, look at here, this person by this name was convicted in Texas. No effort to say they ever actually moved to Florida or that there was the same person or compare address. None of that. Just a similar name. And similar was good enough because, you know, those people use aliases. I mean, this is the Jeb Bush mentality. Is the Republican Party serious about voter fraud? If they are, then why are the Republicans not calling for Jeb Bush to be prosecuted for voter fraud? I mean, Republicans are, they're not only hysterical about voter fraud, they're hysterical about Hispanics. I mean, a bus full of young people from, you know, literally fleeing murder and rape in Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, a bus full of these young kids met by a large group of Republicans saying, get the hell out, go away, you know, scare the hell out of the little kids. So Republicans are hysterical about Hispanics, hysterical about voting fraud, and Jeb Bush committed both. You don't commit Hispanic, but you know what I mean. I mean, Jeb Bush steps into both, right? He claims he's Hispanic on his voting registration form when he's not. He's facing a 5-year felony in the state of Florida. So will the Republicans prosecute? I mean, Florida's run by Republicans. Is Rick Scott going to prosecute Jeb Bush? Has anybody called Rick Scott's office to ask if he's going to prosecute Jeb Bush for voter fraud? That would be a really interesting question. Maybe we can do that during the break at the bottom of the hour. We'll be back. Actually, we'll be one.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I guess we'll have to do it an hour from now. But you know, what do you think? I mean, should he be prosecuted for, or was this just a simple mistake? And if so, how many others are there? And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Gary watching Free Speech TV in Medina, New York. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Good.
The reason why the billionaires are doing everything they can is the, to get all the money they can get, even at the cost of damaging the ecology
mm-hmm.
of the planet. is because they don't plan on being here within the next 15, 20 years anyways. I mean, some will be using breathers and stuff, and they have a dramatically sealed home and stuff like that. But they just want to make the money so they can go to Mars and stuff like that, or go into space. And space. That's why they're working on getting people ready for the space station, is like having them there for a year so they have so they know what they can survive. Transportation to get to Mars, which is about what it's going to take. So, they just need to get the money together to start building their habitats. And so, they really don't care what happens. It says so right in the book of Revelation. So, 1 million people will disappear, and everybody else will be left on this planet to have to deal with what was left behind. And that's basically what it is.
What sounds like your theological argument. Here's the problem with your argument. It's based on logic. You're assuming that these billionaires who are destroying our planet and getting rich doing it, that they're continuing to do that, and that they are funding shills to convince Republicans and anybody that they can that they're actually not doing that harm, that global warming is just a fine thing. Thank you very much. It might even help us. And you're assuming that that they're thinking this out. They're looking forward. They're planning. I don't think that they are. I think that what we're looking at is mental illness, a genuine mental illness. It's a variation on hoarding syndrome. It's like, you walk into somebody's house who has hoarding syndrome. It's a subset of obsessive compulsive disorder, and you can't walk through their house. It's floor to ceiling cans or old newspapers or whatever. I mean, you've seen the pictures, right? The apartments that the collapse and whatnot. And these billionaires, they're doing this with money, and in some cases with homes and with yachts and with private planes and with Maseratis and whatever. And it's just that because it's fancy stuff and they can afford to pay people to keep it nice and clean, we don't call it hoarding syndrome. But it is. It is. They're mentally ill. And their mental illness is destroying
them. They're hermetically sealing it, too.
Pardon?
They're also going to be hermetically sealing it so they don't have to deal with the atmosphere like we do.
Well, they could be. Like I said, Gary, there may be some who are thinking it through and being logical, and maybe they're creating a Galt's Gulch someplace where all the billionaires are going to go when the world implodes as a consequence of the behavior of the billionaires, or at least the sociopathic billionaires. But I'm pretty skeptical that many of these people. I think that their hubris knows no bounds. I think that they believe that no matter what they do, life is going to be great for them. And by the way, it probably will be. History shows, some of the greatest fortunes in America were made during the Great Depression. The outside of family crises like the Getty family is going through right now. People who are rich, multi-generationally rich, genuinely mind-bogglingly billionarily rich, tend to be pretty much insulated from all the problems of society. Even real crises like war, they just leave the country during the war. So. Anyhow, Gary, thanks for the call. We'll be right back. Okay, so, first question, should Jeb Bush be prosecuted? And I mean this seriously. I think that this is, and maybe this is, Rand Paul, by the way, in about an hour, is going to announce that he's running for president. So, and on Sunday, Ted Cruz announced that he's running for president. And Jeb Bush is going to wait as long as he can so that he can suck in unregulated money into his PACs and things, but because he gets it that it's all about the money. But will the other Republicans start seriously being concerned about voter fraud, about Jeb Bush's voter fraud? Okay, enough of that. It's kind of an interesting rant, but there's a bunch of other things I want to get to today that I think are just fascinating. Eleanor Clift. Yesterday I mentioned, Sam Brownback in Kansas. I'm learning more and more of the backstory, and it's more and more bizarre. Sam Brownback went to Congress from Kansas, then he went to the Senate, he went to the House of Representatives, then he went to the Senate, then he came back and ran for governor, and he's now the governor. And he's going to sign a bill, I think today, that would, I'm quoting Eleanor Clift here, Kansas Governor Sam Brownback is poised to sign a bill that would, among other things, bar people on food stamps from using them on cruise ships, a problem that has never existed. This is like Reagan's welfare queen. This is the this is where the Republicans literally invent a lie about how government services are being used. When Ronald Reagan talked about the welfare queen in her Cadillac, who was making six figures, making over $100,000 a year, getting welfare benefits under multiple names, the New York Times embarked on a And not just the New York Times and half the journalists in America on a multi-year crusade to find this woman. Who is this person or somebody doing what she was doing? And they never could find them. But Reagan never gave up that myth. And to this day, I guarantee you that there is no shortage of Republicans running around going, food stamps, $100,000, Cadillacs, welfare queens. Yeah. I mean, seriously. Which means that years from now, you're going to have Republicans sitting around going, you know, there was a time when you could use food stamps to buy food on cruise ships. By the way, I used to own a travel agency. I used to do consulting work for cruise lines. I used to train travel agents, and I used to train marketing and salespeople in the cruise line, the cruise industry itself. I worked for Carnival Cruise Lines. I worked for Crown Cruise Lines. I worked for Royal Caribbean Cruise Lines. These were all, you know, kind of contract things. They were basically Louise and I would take a week-long cruise on their ship, and every day at 3 o'clock we'd take 2 hours and I would train staff people, and then the rest of the cruise was like, hey, let's goof off. And it was wonderful. We got paid and we got a free trip. And I think I had some useful things to say, but the point is that I've been on a lot of cruises, probably at least 30 of them in my life, and I've never paid for food. You don't pay for food on a cruise ship. That's the whole point of a cruise ship. The food is free. It's 24/7 and it's free. And Sam Brownback wants to pass a law barring people from using food stamps on cruise ships when the food is free. I mean, I swear to God, years from now, you are going to have Republicans sitting around.
Food stamp payment, you food stamped on cruise ships. It's outrageous. It's my tax dollars.
Right. I mean, you know, it's not an impossible circumstance that somebody on food stamps could end up on a cruise ship. It's not impossible. People have, the most logical explanation would be a friend or family who's wealthy enough, and cruising is not that expensive. It's really cool. I mean, I love cruising because basically you pack once, the cruise ship is your hotel, and you go from country to country, city to city, and you never have to unpack. And there's continuous free food. But anyway, Sam Brownback. So where did this guy come from? This is where it gets really interesting. Over at Politicus USA. Back in June of 96, the Lawrence, Kansas World Journal did a fiscal check on Kansas congressional delegation freshman representative Sam Brownback. A year earlier, he and his wife Mary had sold 12,800 shares of Stauffer Communications stock for somewhere between $1 and $5 million. Got another $1 million by dumping their kids' stock. The paper reported that the sale came a day or two prior to Stauffer being purchased for $275 million. What a coincidence. Were they acting on inside information? Did they have access to somebody who might have inside information? Well, the next sentence is, Mary Brownback's maiden name was Stauffer. Her granddaddy founded Stauffer Communications. So here we've got a guy, Jeb Bush, vote fraud, Sam Brownback, securities fraud, right? He's worth $10 million. And he wants to pass and sign basically a hate the poor law that's filled with lies, and nonsense.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Meanwhile, I mean, when he came into office, Kansas had a surplus. Now they've got this horrible budget deficit because he cut the taxes on the Koch brothers. Household income hasn't gone up in 10 years in Kansas. The good, the bad, and the very, very pogromly ugly. Right. And there we go. It's moving along. The good. Pope Francis. Of course, Pope Francis. The Pontiff is reportedly writing an encyclical letter in which he will lay out a strong case that Christians have a special responsibility to protect the environment. His letter will apparently call the environment the ultimate pro-life, pro-poor, pro-family issue. You hear that, Republicans? The environment's a pro-life issue! Good on the Pope for helping point that out. The bad, Jeb Bush. According to a report out Monday in the New York Times, the former Florida governor and likely 2016 candidate for president once identified himself as Hispanic on a voter form. That's right, Hispanic. As the Times notes, in a 2009 voter registration application obtained from the Miami County Dade Elections Department, Mr. Bush checked Hispanic in the field that said racist. This is, you know what I mean. Bush denies any wrongdoing, but misrepresenting your race on a voter form is a felony. Class 3 felony, 5 years in jail. By the way, have you ever noticed that when there's an actual case of voter fraud, it's almost always a Republican who's responsible? I'm just saying. And the very, very ugly Jerry Kenney. During a recent episode of his show, America's Survival, the right-wing talk show host compared being gay to rape and cannibalism. Seriously, take a look.
But the one that they say, well, it's natural. And say, okay, well, let's accept that argument. Okay, let's say it's, but there are a lot of things that are natural that aren't necessarily good. In nature, animals rape one another. So should rape be okay? Some animals eat their own waste. Is that okay? You know, animals eat their young. Is our new standard now in this society that we've brought down, and as long as we're at the animal level, then it's okay?
Right, because loving someone who just happens to be the same gender is exactly the same as eating your children. Great logic there, Jerry. That is very, very ugly. That's insanely ugly. Okay, a couple other things I want to share with you here before we move along. Florida Governor Rick Scott. I mentioned this briefly yesterday, but I think that this is really worth some effort talking about this. Rick Scott has flip-flopped on Medicaid expansion for the fourth time. He was opposed to it. He was in favor of it. He was opposed to it. He was in favor of it. Now he's opposed to it. I guess that's the fifth time. When he was running for re-election in 2014, he said, sure, we'll expand Medicaid to poor people in the state. It's 800,000 people, by the way, in the state of Florida who are 100% of them, 100% of them working. The Medicaid expansion is for the working poor. Now, that's a phrase that doesn't even exist in some countries. Right? You would have a really hard time finding the working poor in Finland or Denmark or Sweden or Switzerland or, frankly, Germany or France. I mean, you might find, you'll find some people who are poorly paid, relatively speaking, but they have full health insurance. They have full pensions. They have a social safety net that works. So working poor in the United States means something different, and it means something pretty horrible. So in Florida, like in all these other Republican states, I mean, back in the 60s when Lyndon Johnson invented Medicaid for poor people as a state program funded by the federal government, and it's only 65% funded by the federal government. Most of the money comes from the feds. The rest comes from the state. And it took 5-6 years before every state picked it up. There were a bunch of Republican states that said, nah, we don't want that Medicaid stuff. And then they figured out, this is stupid. Why are we punishing our poor people? Just because we're Republicans. I mean, you know, well, actually, that's why. But in any case. So Rick Scott comes along and says, so in Florida, if you make less than a couple thousand dollars a year, and I don't have the numbers for Florida, they vary from state to state, but they're all pretty much in the same neighborhood, between $2,000 and $4,000 or $5,000 a year, basically. If you make less than that, which would include all the people who are genuinely unemployed. I mean, the deeply poor people, and there are some areas where there's just no jobs. So if you make less than that, you do qualify for the Medicaid program in the state of Florida that's paid for by the federal government mostly, but also by Florida. But the Obamacare Medicaid expansion says that if you make too much to qualify for Medicaid for insurance for the poor in Florida, but enough. It's interesting. There's funny little noises going on and off in here. Our power is flickering. I think maybe the building's getting ready to freak out or something. Who knows? Yeah, no, uninterruptible power supply here for the lights keeps popping. So I think maybe they're doing construction nearby. Anyhow, back to my rant. So in Florida, and in these other red states that have not expanded Medicaid, if you make too much to qualify for the genuinely poor Medicaid, but you don't make enough to qualify for subsidies under Obamacare. You can give free Obamacare if you make 100, and I think it's 128%, maybe it's 138% of poverty. So if you're making basically, you know, $15,000, $18,000 a year, something in that neighborhood, you start qualifying for subsidies under Obamacare. It's for a family of four. But if you make between $3,000 and $15,000, just to pull numbers that are rough approximations out of my ear, you don't qualify for any kind of health insurance in Florida right now. And the federal government will give all of that money, 100% of it, for the first 3 years, 90% forever thereafter, much better deal than the basic Medicaid program, to the states. And the governor of Tennessee was ready to do it. He'd figured out a way to run the money through the private corporations so they could take their skim off the top. Rick Scott, of course, the governor of Florida right now, he ran a company that was convicted of the largest Medicare fraud, in the history of the world. I mean, the guy is a fraudster. He's a healthcare criminal. And now he wants to deny 800,000 people in the state of Florida the right to simply see a doctor when they're sick. What kind of sick, twisted stuff is that? This takes me back to, I mean, who would vote for that? Right? The Republican Party is made up of the rich people like the Koch brothers who don't want anybody to have Medicare. They don't want anybody to have Obamacare. They don't give a rat's ass about Obamacare. I mean, they don't like it. But, you know, in a year or two, this Obamacare tax is going to kick in on Cadillac policies, on these insurance policies that cost $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year that senior executives and really, really rich people have that will, like, fly you all over the world and give you, you know, your private, not just your private room, but maybe even your private suite or your private floor in a hospital. I mean, whatever. I mean, these Cadillac policies, that tax is going to kick in, and the Koch brothers are probably going to have to pay that tax. So let's take down Obamacare. God forbid we should have to pay, you know, a tax on this thing. It's not even actually, you know, that the Koch brothers will pay the tax. It's that their business, which presumably provides them with health insurance, because that's the way you do it tax-free, that their business will only be able to deduct the normal cost of health care from their taxes, and the Cadillac, the rest of it that makes it a Cadillac policy, won't be tax-deductible. So they're going around messing around with all these other states. Americans for Prosperity showing up in Tennessee, running all kinds of ads and blowing up the effort of, what's his name, Halsom, the guy who's the governor of Tennessee, to expand TennCare. Now, I don't know if the Koch brothers and Americans for Prosperity did a big PR thing down in Florida, if it was just a simple email campaign, if it was the Americans for Prosperity phone banks, or if it was just a simple phone call to Rick Scott. hey, buddy, you know, we can do you some help or we can do you some damage, but the Supreme Court has said that we can do it. So you better say no to those 800,000 people and screw them if they die. I mean, to hell with them. We got enough poor people in this country, right? This is the worldview of the Shelley Adelsons and the Koch brothers of this country. Of the plutocrats. Of the billionaires. Of the robber barons. Of the economic royalists. Now, obviously not all of them. There are some very socially conscious billionaires. And very decent people. But there is this small minority. Well, I don't know if it's a minority or a majority of billionaires. I frankly don't know. I mean, when you look at some of these Silicon Valley guys who become super rich and all of a sudden they're libertarian and they're supporting the David Koch agenda. And it's like, really? Is that what happens when you become worth $1 billion? Suddenly your whole life is committed to saying screw everybody else. But anyhow, Rick Scott is now on Monday. Yesterday he came out and said, no, not going to do it. Not going to do it. The excuse, by the way, that he gave, because he was trying to negotiate a deal where they could run the Medicare money, Medicaid money through for-profit corporations in Florida, like, you know, what's his name wanted to do in Tennessee. The excuse is that the guy that he was negotiating with Elliot Fishman, suspended the talks.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archive.
Now, what happened was Elliot Fishman took a couple days off for Passover. Rick Scott says, ha ha, he's suspending the talks. That's it. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Cliff in Canyon Country, California. Hey, Cliff, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind today? Cliff? Uh-oh. Hopefully those little power burps that we were getting did not... Well, we will find out. Let's try Joe in Forest Lake, Minnesota. Joe, can you hear me?
I can, Tom.
Cool. Okay, go for it.
I just wanted to talk about what you were saying about the Cadillac insurance plans.
Right.
And I would submit to you that the wealthy, the truly wealthy, don't even have insurance. Like Rush Limbaugh says, I pay cash. When I go to the hospital. Remember?
Well, he pays cash for his OxyContin.
Union guys who have for decades taken less on our checks in order that we might have better health insurance for our families.
Yeah.
And we're going to have to pay a big hit on that.
No, you're not.
Well, the numbers sure look like I am.
Yeah, my understanding is that these Cadillac, the tax on the Cadillac insurance plans, once again, it's not a tax on you. It is, in fact, it's not even a tax. It's a lack of tax deductibility for your employer. And it's over a certain threshold. And I've heard that talking point many, many times from Republican shills, Joe. And I don't believe it's true. I just don't believe it. And, you know, if it was, the unions would be screaming about it. So I'm just, you know, nice try. James in Spokane, Washington. Hey, James, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I haven't talked to you for a while. You're looking good.
Thanks. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
You know, the Republicans are always claiming that people should be pulling themselves up by their bootstraps, and they're crying, I'm a victim of this and a victim of that.
Right.
I mean, the question is, aren't we all victims of our circumstances? And theirs made them wealthy, and they're turning their back on the people whose circumstances put them in you know, less beneficial position.
Well, what they're doing, I mean, you know, if you believe in the philosophy of people pulling themselves up by their bootstraps, then you have to have some understanding of what bootstraps are. And if somebody is literally hungry, I mean, if somebody does not have bus fare to get to a job interview or to get to work, if somebody, you know, cannot afford to pay the rent, you know, they don't have bootstraps.
Hey, Tom, another thing. If you try to pull yourself up by your bootstraps, don't you land on your ass?
Good point, James. Good point.
Another thing I was saying, you know, we're all victims of circumstances.
Yeah.
And the rich people's circumstances are that they're rich.
Yeah.
They're able to help, but they're turning their back on the poor people and claiming they're not victims.
Yeah.
And we're all victims of our circumstances.
Yeah, or beneficiaries.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And in ways that aren't often the ones that everybody thinks about. I mean, at least all white people think about. I mean, you know, white privilege is a huge circumstance that white people are the beneficiaries of. And
so a few things are clear cut.
Yeah.
So, you know,
yeah.
Things are very vague.
And yeah, you're right. James, thanks for the call. I mean, I just, the other day I was in a store and I bought something and the clerk who was black gave me my receipt and I said, you can throw that away. And she said, oh, you don't want me to throw it away. You don't want to get stopped by somebody thinking you're shoplifting. And I was like, I'm 64 years old. Well, I will be in a month. I've been on this planet more than 60 years, and I have never been stopped for shoplifting. I didn't say that to her. I mean, what immediately hit me is that if I was black, I would have to be thinking, I need that receipt just in case. And I routinely throw away receipts and walk out with the product, you know, stuck in my jacket pocket for them that I paid for. We'll be right back. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you and John in Gilbert, Arizona. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It's always great listening to you.
Thank you.
Hey, I don't want to beat a dead horse, but I guess my biggest thing that I do understand, but I don't understand, why is it that if you're a politician, you don't get sent to a sanitarium when you're crazy and want to, you know, be mean to everybody, but if you're not a politician, that's the way we get treated. And I understand the Koch brothers and the money situation and all that stuff and your suckers and all that, but I don't understand why they're exempt from everything. I mean, when people apply for jobs, we get background checks and multi-personality checks, but when you're a politician, there's none of that. And I think that's part of the biggest problem.
Well, here's the problem. I mean, the theory is that the background check and the analysis and all that is done by either opposing political parties or persons or by the voters. And the vetting process that we have is called elections. And I think that that's an entirely reasonable thing. And I would be very wary of a government that went in and determined who is, you know, legitimately eligible for voting and who isn't. In fact, I think we're way too far down that road already, with basically a locked out two-party system. Now, all that said, there does have to be a certain level of congressional immunity, shall we say, or government immunity, because, you know, government actions can have substantial and far-reaching consequences. And if an individual politician is making a decision based on what they think is the best thing, you know, I'm not sure I'd want them nailed. I mean, it's a tough job. It's like the same thing with doctors. You know, doctors screw up from time to time. I had a doctor screw me up. I mean, you know, it happens. And, you know, one remedy is to sue them. But more often than not, you just say, you know, life in the big city. And so, you know, I get your concern, John, but I think that the solution is for our voters to be more educated and for all of us to get inside the political parties and take them over. John, thanks for the call. Anita in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Anita, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great. What's up?
It seems to me that the story's always pretty much been the same. Whenever someone comes around that stands up for the poor and the working class people, and it threatens the powerful and the elite. And this has been the story since Jesus. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Jesus was a threat.
Right.
To the powerful.
Right.
And he
and they crucified him.
You know, the poor people are the chosen people. Imagine how threatening that was.
Mm-hmm.
And that rich people were going to have a really hard time getting into heaven.
Well, and I think that, you know, a huge pushback to this is this whole prosperity theology movement in the largely within the Protestant Christian church in the United States that suggests that if you just become an evangelical Protestant, or and there's a big strain of it in Mormonism as well, that you will become blessed by God, a.k.a. wealthy. And that is absolutely, in my opinion, inconsistent with the teachings of Christ. And excellent position or point, Anita. Thank you for calling and making it. Cliff in Canyon Country, California. Hey, Cliff, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon.
We got cut off a minute ago.
My apologies.
I've been calling your program for years, and you've really taught me so much, Tom, and I respect you immensely.
But?
Here it comes.
But?
But. Something you said last week almost floored me, Tom, and I just had to respond, because you were talking about the Iran nuclear negotiations, and It is a BFD, using Joe Biden's words. It really is a big deal. But you made the suggestion of a second Nobel Peace Prize for President Obama, and yours is an opinion show. So here's mine, Tom. The first Nobel that the president was awarded was a travesty and undeserving, because he received it before he actually did anything. It was for a speech or two. And since then, you know, he inherited the aerial assassination program from the war criminal George W. Bush, and he expanded it four or five fold, you know. You're familiar with Dirty Wars and Jeremy Scahill. I mean, this program is terrorism to the Muslim world. And John Brennan, a couple of years ago, making the claim that no civilians were killed while they bombed wedding parties and grandmas tending crops and a 16-year-old from Denver, USA, and hundreds of other innocent civilians. And to go on, that the destruction of Libya, which is a flaming disaster.
Cliff, I get it. I got your list.
You don't want me to finish my list?
Yeah, no, there's no need to finish your list. I could do it for you. And it's been done many times in this program. I'm pretty sure when I said that the other day, I said that now President Obama deserves a Nobel Prize. If he can make this Iran deal work, he deserves the Nobel Prize that was given to him when he became president. And in fact, at the time, as I recall, I made the kind of, I suppose, snarky remark that Obama got the Nobel Prize for not being George Bush. And I think that there was a large piece of that. I think the international community was freaked. I mean, they were looking at American politics and at George W. Bush's behavior and, you know, lying us into wars and dragging European countries with us and, you know, freedom fries and all this other stuff. They were like, you know, thank God Bush is gone. Here, give him a Nobel Prize, you know, to Obama, you know, to his successor, at, you know, who has repudiated Bush's war talk, or at least much of it, who stopped the torture program, who opened many of these things up. Obviously not anywhere near as much as you or I would like, but a hell of a lot better than certainly Mitt Romney would have done or John McCain, God forbid.
Can I mention one more thing real quick?
Sure.
Before we finish. All right. The arms deal with Saudi Arabia, the biggest in history, $60 billion. And now they're using those weapons of death to bomb the bleep out of Yemen. I mean, so.
And this is going to be a really interesting one to watch, Cliff. There's a very interesting analysis here, because Saudi Arabia just got a new king, and his son, I believe it is, might be one of his nephews, but I think it's one of his sons, is now the Minister of Defense. And he put together this strategy to go in and bomb the Shia Muslims in Syria. In Yemen, and it looks like it's going to backfire on him. And this is going to be a huge mess for the Saudi royal family.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. I brought this topic up yesterday, and I wanted to just revisit it with our old friend Neil McCabe, the conservative columnist with townhall.com and the editor of the Washington Mercury news site, thewashingtonmercury.com. Neil, welcome back.
Great to be with you, Tom. Happy Easter to you and all of your listeners, though. Sometimes your listeners are not always kind to me on Twitter after our appearances, but happy Easter to everyone.
Okay. Be nice to Neil, please. All right.
Yeah.
Neil.
I'm just a guy, you know.
It takes 78 calories of fossil fuel to produce 1 calorie of beef protein. It takes 35 calories to produce 1 calorie of pork, 22 calories of fossil fuel to create 1 calorie of poultry, but only 1 calorie of fossil fuel to create 1 calorie of soybeans. John Robbins calculates that if Americans just cut their meat consumption by 10%, we could feed 100 million people around the world, which is about the number of people who are actually starving to death every year. in this planet. It takes 15 times more water to produce a pound of animal protein than it does vegetable protein. And you want to reduce your risk of a heart attack by 90%, go vegan. Stop eating all animal products, period. So what's wrong with that? And on top of that, now we've got the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee. It's a federally appointed panel of nutritionists created in 1983 by Ronald Reagan, nonpartisan. And they provide the core material for the guidelines that the Department of Ag comes out with every year through HHS and the recommendations. And they just came out and said, let me get this quote right. I don't have the quote. I should have found it. Oh, the organically grown vegan diet has the lowest estimated impact on resources and ecosystem quality, and the average Italian diet had the greatest projected impact, according to the report. Beef was the single food with the greatest projected impact on the environment. Other foods estimated to have high impact include cheese, milk, and seafood. Should we not consider how much fossil fuel we're using and thus how much money we're pouring into the Middle East quagmire and all that kind of stuff? Should we not consider the damage that we're doing to the planet? And frankly, should we not consider our own health when making dietary decisions, particularly when we the people, make recommendations to ourselves about how we should be eating?
Well, Tom, you know, we all know people. We all have people in our family who, for whatever reason, have become vegetarians. And, you know, we don't hate them. We don't ostracize them. We love them. We embrace them. And whatever their reasons are, we're not really there to judge them. But at the same time, we're not going to give up cheeseburgers. And, if we can't eat what we want, what's the point of being an American?
I'm not saying that you should give up your cheeseburger.
Where in the world do you go, Tom, to eat what you want to eat if you can't do it in America?
Neil, how did my talking about eating less meat, being good for the planet and being good for our health, suddenly be turned into a Hitler-like big government draconian program that eliminates all meat from all stores?
Well, this is obviously this is just the starting point, Tom. I mean, you get the White House.
It's the old slippery slope argument.
Sign off on this panel. These 14 scientists have cooked this thing up with the intent of informing Americans about global warming and climate change through the dietary guidelines. They hijacked.
It's real science, Neil.
Nonpartisan.
It's real science. It really does take 78 calories of fossil fuel to make 1 calorie of beef protein, whereas it only takes 1 calorie of fossil fuel to make 1 calorie of cauliflower. Shouldn't you be eating cauliflower or potatoes or bread or whatever instead of beef? I'm not saying should you be forced to. That's a silly argument.
I mean, what are you going to do? Are you going to tax my meat? I mean, you don't see this. You don't see this as the beginning of regulating the diet. I mean, you don't see
the three areas, to the best of my knowledge.
You don't see people on your side of the aisle looking to control the menu of Americans?
No, I don't. I realize Republicans think that way, but by and large, Democrats don't. And the three things that are used.
Who's taken over the school lunch, and they've turned school lunch what was a traumatic at best, and they've just made it horrible.
The three things that these dietary guidelines are used for, school lunch is one of them, is for recommending school lunches. Number two is for teaching nutrition to people. And number three ultimately ends up to have to do with product packaging and things like that, you know, deciding what people need to be informed about, what do they need to know about, should we worry about sodium or not. You know, things have evolved, for example, on sodium on that one front.
You make a very good point.
And as our knowledge evolves, things change. If the consequence of this is that less meat is served in our school lunch programs, that's going to mean that you're going to have fewer kids who are obese. You're going to have fewer kids who are diabetic in their 20s, 30s, and 40s. You're going to have fewer kids who have heart disease in their 40s and 50s.
But Tom,
isn't that a good thing? I mean, that saves us all money, if nothing else, Neil. Look at it as a Republican.
Kids should grow up to be big and strong, and they need to drink their milk, and they need to eat beef, and they need to exercise, and all of those things that you're saying.
What is the biggest, strongest animal on earth, Neil?
No, but Tom.
Neil, what's the biggest, strongest animal on earth?
Say again?
What's the biggest, strongest animal on earth?
The blue whale?
Well, it could be, actually, yeah. and they're not vegetarian, but I was thinking elephants and hippos and bison.
Man is the most dangerous game, Tom, as you know.
Right, yeah, hippos will kill you, but they will not eat you because they're vegetarians. In fact, they're vegans.
But shouldn't kids...
So if you want to be big and strong, you know, there's a whole body, you know, there's a vegan bodybuilder movement.
Oil is. That's what I'm saying. Who cares what the price of oil is? Kids should eat what's going to make them big and strong and smart.
And meat and milk merely increase their probability of illness, including cancer. I mean, the milk is filled with pus. The meat is filled with, you know, it's dead meat to begin with, and it's laced with hormones and bacteria.
That's not scandalous, Tom. I mean, yes, it's dead meat.
Yeah. I find that scandalous. I mean, the idea of putting a dead animal in my mouth and chewing it up. My God, when I was 16 when I quit eating meat. When I was 17, I had this sudden Burger King craving, a cheese whopper, you know. And you know, I drove through Burger King and I bought a cheese whopper. I thought, okay, I'm going to do this. I took one bite out of it, hit a piece of gristle, and it so grossed me out that I had to pull over to the side of the curb and barf on the street. That was the last time, with one single exception, which is a whole other longer story. That was the last time I ate meat in my life. That was like, you know, 50 years ago.
I've lived in a predominantly Italian community in my life. And when you said that, you know, it's like when you were comparing the different diets and then Italy was supposedly the worst. I mean, I've also lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where I accidentally bought, I didn't realize it was a vegan cookie. And it's like, what? It was horrible. It was absolutely horrible.
Yeah, there's some pretty terrible health food out there. I agree with you.
Chip cookie before.
But there's also some really great food out there, you know, that's good for you.
Maybe. I mean, listen, we all like tofu, and we love the way it absorbs the sauce. But it shouldn't be, like, because some government bureaucrat or these 14 maniacs.
So let me get this straight. You're opposed to our tax dollars being used to inform us about the current state of science with regard to eating. Is that it?
I think we should probably dial it back. I had no problem when it wasn't for political purposes, but when these guys are now plugged in to the global warming debate,
how is that political?
They should take a breath.
The only people who are trying to say it's political are the oil barons like the Koch brothers and Rex Tillerson. This is not political.
I mean,
There's an absolute consensus that burning fossil fuels is stupid. Not only does it make us more vulnerable to things like 9/11, but it also, you know, is destroying our atmosphere.
Well, fracking makes us less vulnerable to a 9/11.
No, but it makes us a lot more vulnerable to being poisoned by our drinking water.
No longer tied to the Middle East. If we have fracking, sets us free, Tom.
It sets us free for our houses to fall down when hundreds of earthquakes come in. Okay, Neil. Always good talking with you. Neil McCabe, conservative columnist with townhall.com and editor of the Washington Mercury news site, thewashingtonmercury.com. Thanks, Neil.
All right, be good.
Good talking with you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
If you want to really learn about this stuff, there's a great website. It's called nutritionfacts.org. Check it out. Welcome back, 15 minutes past the hour. And, okay. Other things in the news today. Somehow I think, you know, veganism is not going to be something that trips an enormous, you know, landslide of phone calls. But this is interesting. This, Dr. Greger, he's the guy who runs the website, nutritionfacts.org. He says, last year we learned in a study of Buddhist nuns that long-term vegans for up to 72 years straight, they were looking at Buddhist nuns. Buddhism teaches vegetarianism. And these were women who lived in an environment where their diet was controlled for them. Over 72 years of continuous vegan eating, not just vegetarian, but vegan, had clinically equivalent bone mineral density despite milk-drinking women getting twice as much calcium. This year, he says, there was a 200-page review published in Health Indicators in people eating vegetarian long-term. What about protein status? Both vegans and meat eaters on average get the recommended amount of protein in their daily diet. Meat eaters eat 20% more protein, but who has the higher blood plasma protein levels? Vegans. Their bodies are apparently working right. They're apparently, you know, using food the way that they should and all that kind of stuff. Anyhow, Steve, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network in Glendale or Oregon?
Yeah.
Is there a Glendale in Oregon?
Yes, there is.
Hey, Steve.
Good morning.
So what's on your mind?
Well, the forestry issues here in Oregon, I mean, you're talking about farming, and you're absolutely right about cattle. I grew up on a dairy farm and raised livestock all my life.
Yeah.
But anyway, what I wanted to talk about was our senators here in Oregon have proposed doubling the timber harvest on federal lands in Oregon. And these timber lands can't sustain the cut they have now. But they're calling this a jobs bill. But modern equipment, the feller buncher, the harvester, the processors, have taken the jobs out of the woods. So calling this a jobs bill is pretty misleading.
Well, it still creates jobs. It just doesn't create the number of jobs it used to.
Well, it creates a few. There's a new machine, a prototype of a new machine that will cut the tree, limit, buck the log, load it in a bunk, carry it out, and load the truck.
Wow.
So, I mean, that's going to replace pretty much everyone.
Yeah, this is like the cotton gin revolutionizing production of cotton back in the 1830s or something.
Yeah, it'd be the same kind of idea, but it really is taking the people out of the woods. But
yeah.
Anyway, this is federal. So it's the senators nationwide that are going to be approving the harvest here in Oregon.
Right.
But the way they're harvesting, they're going too far. When they spread these, when they thin, they're cutting it so they can get the cable down through the woods for the yarder.
Right.
If they would go a few feet and then a few feet and a few feet like you would do in your vegetable garden, it wouldn't be quite such a horrible thing. But the way they're doing it, rather than taking out the diseased trees, the dying trees, the bent trees, they're going for the money, and they're cutting out the good wood and leaving the junk spread 20 feet apart. And then when we have a fire, it burns so fast that it can't be fought, and what's left is harvestable.
Yeah.
So it almost seems like they're doing it on purpose. But.
Well, yeah. Steve, thanks for the call. I can't speak intelligently to that. I'm familiar with the topic, but I'm no expert on it. But I appreciate your call and your concern. And please let your senators, Begichin, and not Begichin. Welcome back. Say what? Merkley was his name. Yes. Senator Merkley, Senator Wyden, the Oregon senators. There we go. Just for the record. Michelle in Alamo, California. Hey, Michelle. What's up?
Hey, Tom, I'm so glad you're talking about veganism. You just made my day.
Thank you.
I love your show. Thank you so much for what you do. I just wanted to kind of put some info out there. I'm a vegan fitness pro, and I've been vegan for 16 years.
Wow, that's a long time.
Yeah, I love it. And I've inspired 10 people to go vegan, so that's the whole point.
Yeah.
But I've practiced Kung Fu all over the world, won world championships as a vegan. I never had any problem with my practice. I eat whole foods vegan, though I don't take much sugar or processed sugar at all.
Right.
And processed food I avoid, you know, when I can. But the interesting thing is that I have probably 100 people cross my path 5 days a week, you know, with all the classes I teach. And I never get sick.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't get colds. I don't, you know, I don't. And I'm crossing a lot of germs. I see kids all the time. You know, I'm careful with, I don't, you know, use my hands to touch my face as much as, you know, maybe most people do. But, you know, I think it's really interesting that there's so much sickness out there. I don't get a flu shot. But I really do think that people, like this guy, you have this columnist, he's so afraid of what it is to not have his burger, you know, what that infringes on his personal rights. And really, you know, it's just one way of looking at it. There's so much good food that is so much more respectful to your body and to the planet that you can enjoy.
And I got to tell you, Michelle, veggie burgers taste better. I mean, they make really good veggie burgers now. They've got lots and lots of flavor. The texture is great. You can put sauces and things on them. I mean, it really tastes good.
Well, yeah. I mean, my husband makes a mean veggie burger, and it doesn't take hours. He mashes some sweet potato and some beans, and he puts it all together. And, you know, we serve this stuff to meat eaters all the time, and they're like, wow, I don't feel so bad, so heavy. And my mother and father-in-law are a great example. They were kind of, you know, confused at first because they're in their 70s, and being vegan was like a lot to them because, of course, my husband was vegetarian when we met, and he found it easy to become vegan. But they eat, you know, 90% plant-based now, and they for their health, it's, you know, totally changed their health. They've both lost, like, 30 pounds, whereas they just, quote-unquote, couldn't lose it before. But, you know, there's unhealthy ways of eating anything. You could eat all processed food. You could eat plastic and be vegan.
Yeah, it's very possible to be a vegan and be very unhealthy because you're eating crappy food. Just because it doesn't have meat in it doesn't mean it's not bad food.
Yeah,
I mean, people live on try living on Twinkies, you know. God forbid.
Most of them are vegan, but maybe they are. And I've never eaten a Twinkie in my life. I've also never walked into a McDonald's in my life, which I'm proud to say.
Wow.
So, but the point I wanted to make is that we're all really programmed from when we're born to every holiday to, you know, what we have at school for, you know, a lunch program, you know, eat, can I say crap? I'm on SiriusXM.
Yeah.
Eat junk.
Yeah.
You know, and we're, our taste buds are programmed to eat sugar and salt. And that's really what people are craving because that's, you know, their association with all these things that we've been programmed to. And it doesn't surprise me one bit that this columnist gets so defensive about this because, you know, to me, and I have a lot of conservatives in my family, they're defensive about a lot of things that it's just a fear of change.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a fear of something that's a little bit different infringing on their personal rights. And it's not about that. I mean, I'm vegan because I really care about my effect on other animals.
I wonder why there seems to be a political alignment. You know, it's like the meat eaters.
It's a house of cards.
Pardon?
It's a house of cards. It's a house of cards. You pull out that one card and the whole thing's going to fall down. You know, my father is a great example. I love him to death. He's 76, but you even say the word Obama and Obama has.
But Obama's not a vegetarian.
No, of course, right?
So, so why is vegetarianism associated with liberals and Democrats, and eating meat and having heart attacks when you're 55 years old is associated with being a Republican?
Because the Beef Council, I would be willing to bet, isn't a bunch of liberals. The people that are funding all of our sicknesses, I'm looking at it from the outside.
It's the old suckers routine.
Yeah.
It's the beef industry is a huge profitable, highly monolithic, largely monopolistic industry, and not just beef, poultry, and seafood, but each one of these, and then the dairy industry, all of these industries,
and
they spend all this money to try to reel the suckers in, of course.
And then they sell them for life because they can put them right into the hospital and give them all their medication.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, I mean,
it's fascinating.
I don't think a lot of people want us to be well, and when people get defensive about the FDA saying that a whole diet. I don't care if the word
Michelle, pardon my interrupting you. Your phone is starting to really disintegrate, and I need to move along. But thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing your story with us. I appreciate it. Mark, it doesn't say where you are. Mark, where are you?
I'm actually here just outside of Orlando, Florida.
Okay. So you have a story to tell?
I've got a story for you. Let's see here. A few years ago, I had a fall, and some problems arose with my spine, and I was on my way to a neurosurgeon and all that, and I had a junk insurance policy, and they told me the final price, and I was like, well, I guess I'll just deal with pain management. Well, that didn't happen because the wonderful law of Obamacare came around, and I thought I'd actually get fixed. I'm actually sitting out front of an emergency room right now waiting to be seen.
Wow.
And you don't
qualify for Medicaid expansion? Is that the problem?
Oh, I don't, because of the wonderful Rick Scott. Me and my friends, if you've ever seen Shadow of the Vampire with John Malkovich.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
10 seconds, Mark. Finish your thought.
Sure, not a problem.
Yeah. Okay, Mark, thank you very much for the call. Thanks for sharing the story with us. We'll be back. Welcome back. 28 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, nutrition facts. Stop calling this man libertarian. This is fascinating. I will pick up your calls in just a moment. But Joan Walsh, writing in Salon Magazine, alternate picked it up. Nothing screams I'm a libertarian like a creepy, cultish, rhyming campaign slogan, don't you think? Something like, defeat the Washington machine, unleash the American dream, which is Rand Paul's new motto. Okay, Rand Paul And I know I'm being praised in Twitter for not talking about Rand Paul. And thank you for that. And I'm not going to talk about him a lot because I really think that he's a footnote to this whole thing. He's another part of the clown show, you know, the Republican clown car. But he pretends that he's a libertarian. And real libertarians understand what being a libertarian is all about. Real libertarians like David Koch, they understand, you know, who ran for vice president of the United States in 1988 or 1980 on the libertarian ticket. And their platform was privatize Social Security, do away with Medicare, do away with all your welfare programs, do away with all laws that have to do with that in any way regulate the use of money in politics. So rich people can buy politicians all they want, anytime they want. You know, bust up unions. I mean, you know, Bernie Sanders loves to read the list. You've heard it on this program. Real libertarians understand that being a libertarian means that you are in favor of a world that is run by rich people and large corporations, and governments do not have the power to stand up to those rich people or big corporations, and therefore do not have the power to protect the average person. Real libertarians get that. And they're okay, you know, they're down with it because real libertarians are probably less than 1% of the people who call themselves libertarians. Most people who call themselves libertarians are college kids who read, you know, Atlas Shrugged or something and think, you know, hey, libertarian, decriminalize pot and prostitution. I guess I still do call libertarians those kind of libertarians, Republicans who want to get high and get laid. Excuse me, they want to get laid and smoked up. I mean, it's like, that's pretty much all there is. And this is the lens through which they view all this stuff. Yes, there are areas where the government is just, in my opinion, wrong. I think our drug policies are wrong. I think that, you know, drug use and abuse in the United States should be a medical issue like it is in Portugal or Ecuador rather than a criminal issue like it is here. And when Reagan took Nixon's drug war and put it on steroids in 1981, we saw the prison population in the United States explode. I mean, just explode to where it is today. But anyhow, John Walsh pointing out, you know, Rand Paul is not a libertarian. He's a hustler. He's just a hustler. And he's not, and to go through his positions and say, okay, that's libertarian and this isn't, and therefore he is or he isn't really a libertarian, is really to give credibility to the whole, quote, libertarian movement, end quote, which I think, in my opinion, has no credibility. I mean, look at the former Charles Koch Foundation, now renamed the Cato Institute, which is the principal libertarian think tank in America. It's the Charles Koch Foundation, the second richest family in America. Real libertarians are like, you know, real billionaires. They get it. Screw the average guy. I got mine. That's their philosophy. Anyhow, enough of that. I'm done with my Rand Paul rant for the day. Johnny in Crawfordville, Florida. Hey, Johnny, what's on your mind?
How you doing, buddy? Let's get off. I think you should rename the Republican group the Clown Cause.
There you go. Yeah. Well, it happens every 4 years. You get these really bizarre people doing these Republican primary debates, and you know that half of those people, there's no way that they're even qualified to be, you know, a county sheriff, much less president of the United States.
Because they got money.
Or money behind them. You know, because the guys who are running for president are not, with the exception of Mitt Romney, they're not the billionaires. They're not the plutocrats. They're the shills for the plutocrats. They're that second, that middle category. You know, you got the billionaires, you got the shills for the billionaires, and you got the suckers. And their job is to bring along the suckers.
Yeah, they got, I agree with you. But, you know, one more thing, man. I mean, back on the vegetarian thing.
Sure.
That's what I call. You know, I know a lot of vegetarians, and they really don't look healthy.
Hmm.
I mean, I'm not sure, like I said, I'm not sure what they eat.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, you're right. We Americans need to cut back on our meat. I agree with you. I've cut back on my meat. I mean, I cut back on my sodium because I have this issue that if I have too much sodium, I get dizzy.
Yeah, it's probably high blood pressure.
Well, no, it's not. It's too much sodium in my body. It's called, I forgot what it's called, but
okay.
I cut back on it.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel so much better.
Oh, that's good.
I cut back on my meat, but I just got to have meat once in a while to have that protein.
Sure.
Because I work out like crazy.
Yeah, well, I'm not saying that nobody should ever eat meat. And, in fact, I think that you can make a strong argument that that people who periodically eat small, oily fish, sardines, herring, kippered herrings, things like that, on a semi-regular basis. In fact, the last study I saw showed that people who ate 100 grams, which is, about 3 ounces, roughly, of small, oily fish at least once a month over the course of their lifetimes had some really substantially diminished risk for dementia in their older age. And
well,
so,
you can
build it, but I know of no arguments like that for beef or for dairy products, for milk or for eggs. And in fact, people, just the idea that we're drinking milk is kind of bizarre. I have a friend who's Japanese who, literally was born in Japan, raised in Japan, came to the United States for 5 years, worked as a banker here in the United States, went back to Japan. Louise and I were staying at his home and his wife a couple of years back, almost a decade now. And he took us out to this to a Pizza Hut restaurant because it was an American restaurant in downtown Tokyo. Thought we would be all excited about it. And they didn't serve cheese. I mean, they you could ask for it, but the normal pizza did not have cheese. And I was like, how come there's no cheese in the pizza? And he was like, there's no cheese in any Japanese food. He said, here's how we think of cheese. You have the secretion from the mammary gland of a large mammal, and you squeeze that secretion out, and then you let it rot. And that's what you guys call cheese. That's what we call gross. And
yeah, but also they also, certain countries over there, they also kill dogs and eat them.
Yeah, well, Japan doesn't do that.
Not all of them.
That's more an issue of poverty than good nutrition. And, tragically.
They make it cheap. If they make it cheaper, the problem is you go into Whole Food stores, it's like, God, it's so expensive.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's why they call it Whole Paycheck.
I love fresh food. I love it. I eat it like crazy. I'm a truck driver, so, I got a cooler and I pack it full of good stuff.
Yeah.
But I don't know, man. It's so hard these days to eat good.
Well, it just takes a little thought, and you're right. It does take a little extra money, and that's a very unfortunate consequence of previous food pyramids and things that were written largely by the food industry, saying, "Oh yeah, meat, dairy is an important part of your," and also this whole processed food thing, the food oligopoly that we've got, or monopoly that we've got. It's a serious problem. Johnny, thanks for the call. I got to move along here. Devin in Houston, Texas. There we go. Hey, Devin. Whoop. What's on your mind?
The unthinkable happened. Tom, I finally disagree with you.
Okay.
With the last person you were talking to, talking about, I never get sick because I'm a vegan. You could say there's no vegans with heart problems or that are out of shape and high blood pressure.
It's very rare, frankly. Yes, actually.
Well, I've never.
And you can look it up. In fact, I'll tell you, here's, Devin, let me challenge you on this and call me back in a couple of days after you've done it. Go over to nutritionfacts.org, and down at the bottom of the page, there's a one-hour YouTube video of Dr. Greger giving a speech in which he lists the 15 leading causes of death in the United States. One of them is accidents, but all the rest of them are medical things. Every single one of those 15 leading causes of death in the United States is reduced. Most of them reduced dramatically by going on a diet that does not have meat, chicken, fish, eggs, or meat or milk in it. Every single one of them.
Okay, I agree 100% with milk because humans are the only adult mammals who drink milk. But what other animal with their eyes in the front of their head that has predator vision doesn't eat any meat?
Oh yeah, well, and that's one of the, I think, fairly legitimate debates, Devin, is. What are we designed to be? There are primates who are largely vegetarian, like gorillas. There are other primates who enthusiastically eat meat, like chimpanzees. And we're related to both, although we're probably more closely related to chimpanzees. The question is, in the 3 million years since we diverged from them in the evolutionary tree, did we adapt ourselves more to a vegetarian kind of diet than to a meat-eating kind of diet? I mean, if you look at the teeth of a cat, you're looking at the teeth of a carnivore, okay? Look at the teeth of a dog or a bear, you're looking at the teeth of an omnivore. Our teeth don't look like either one. On the other hand, you look at the teeth of a cow, you're looking at a pure vegetarian. So maybe we're sort of designed to be omnivore-ish. And, you know, there's a lot of theories that basically we were scavengers back in the day. But the human diet as a largely vegetarian diet has always, as you know, always been the case with me. But typically, you look at the older cultures, you know, people, you know, they'll eat meat, but they use it as a seasoning, or they'll toss it in, you know, it's on Fridays, or it's on the weekend, or it's the special thing. It's not the everyday, you know, eating a pound and a half of beef a day. Listen, the Americans are killing themselves.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So, anyway, all things in moderation. How's that for a starting point? As John Robbins pointed out, if we just cut our meat consumption by 10%, we could feed 100 million people. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour, and Paul in South Lyon, Michigan. Hey, Paul, you wanted to talk about President Obama and drone strikes in response to that earlier Republican caller?
Yeah. There was a caller who forgot what it was like with Republicans in the White House. I think Obama does deserve a Nobel Peace Prize for ending three wars, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya. He's only using airstrikes against terrorists to protect us. There was a civil war in Libya, thousands being slaughtered before Obama stopped it with airstrikes. You know, I'm not saying it's great now, but it was a whole lot worse then.
Yeah.
And that 16-year-old boy from Denver that he referred to was not targeted. He was with terrorists who were targeted and who were engaged in trying to kill us, and his dad was their leader.
Right.
So thanks, Obama, for protecting us the way it should be done, with one or two civilian casualties once in a while instead of hundreds of thousands the way Republicans do it.
Yeah. I understand what you're saying, Paul, and your sentiment is, for me, speaking just for myself, is closer to mine than the Obama is a war criminal and, you know, we should go after him for drone strikes. That said, though, I would feel a whole heck of a lot more comfortable if there was some sort of deliberative judicial process when it comes to using drone strikes, particularly against Americans or non-combatants. And of course, this is one of the problems, who's a combatant and who's a non-combatant. But if you know, even if an American has gone over to the other side, as long as that other side, well, it shouldn't even be any as long as. Due process, either we have a declared war or we have due process. And frankly, we don't have either one right now. So that troubles me. I don't lay that on Obama's, you know, doorstep. The fact that we don't have a declared war, I think we take that up with Congress. That's their job. It's right there, Article 1, Section 18, or Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution.
But the problem with that, though, Tom, is time is of the essence. When they target a terrorist, they don't have time to, you know, have a trial or whatever you're referring to. It's like,
well, you have the trial 3 months earlier.
Innocent people. It's like somebody who's shooting innocent people. The police have to just shoot them and stop them. You know, they don't have time to have a trial first.
I understand the argument, and there may be times when that argument is a serious, legitimate rationale for killing a terrorist or for blowing up a wedding party. But we knew for months that this American had gone over to that side. We had plenty of time to have a trial and convict him. And sentence
him off, and then he gets tipped off, and he hides. So
he knew that we knew. Come on, it was in the newspapers.
What are you talking about?
We're talking about Zarqawi, right?
Al-Awlaki.
Al-Awlaki. Thank you. Yeah, I mix up some of those names. Al-Awlaki and his son. The killing of his son, I still think is highly problematic. Al-Awlaki, we could have easily had a trial for him. He knew that we knew that he was there. He was bragging about being there. I mean, his being there was part of their publicity. We've got an American on our side. We could have had a trial for that guy.
Oh, okay. And that wouldn't have tipped him off to go into hiding.
No. I mean, he was already in hiding. He thought he was safe. He thought he was protected. And even if what that means is that we don't get him, I think holding to your principles, and one of our core principles, 6th, 7th, 8th, and you know, 6th, 7th, 8th amendments to the Constitution, is due process. Paul, thanks for the call. We'll be back. 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Talk Radio News is not with us. I'm guessing it's probably because Victoria's... Oh, Luke Vargas is going to call in? I was going to say maybe it's because Victoria's over at the White House and they've had a power outage or something. But oh, it's Ellen? Ellen is with us? Oh, okay. She will be with us momentarily. So we are going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by Who Are You Thankful For? To see an example, go to thanklist.com/watch, and you can watch the story of Shalene and Kier, the slave from South Sudan. And it's an amazing story. It's an absolutely amazing story. And Shalene and Ellen are married. Kier is Ellen's adopted son, literally a slave from South Sudan. It's an amazing, amazing story. So, do we have Ellen? Do I see her on the board? Oh, yeah, there she is. Okay, Ellen Ratner, you're on the line. Hey, Ellen.
Well, thank you so much. First of all, today is the anniversary of the beginning of Rwanda 21 years ago. And as you know, Hillary Clinton is probably going to announce in the next 2 weeks. What's so fascinating is I remember the pink press conference that she gave on the 22nd of April. And there was also an off-the-record sort of background briefing for press as well that same, I think it was the day before, that day. And in neither the background briefing nor the pink press conference, which was focused on how she turned $1,000 into $100,000 in money, nobody asked about Rwanda. And you just have to wonder where the press is in some of this.
What's going on in Rwanda that we need to be asking about?
Nothing. It's just that it's the anniversary of it.
Oh, I see. The anniversary of the slaughter.
Yeah. In 21 years, they have not changed. The press has not changed their stripes in many of these ways.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and okay. Americans tend to have a short memory.
They do. At the Summit of the Americans, which is going to happen at Guatemala on Friday, there's going to be an interaction, but not a meeting, with Raul Castro and President Obama.
Hmm.
So I don't know what an interaction is going to be. Senator Schumer of New York City, or New York State, he was actually New York City as well, he will most likely be the Democratic leader, said he would support legislation that would allow Congress to reject the nuclear deal with Iran. He supports a bill by Bob Corker of Tennessee that would allow Congress to stop the nuclear deal being worked on in Switzerland. And I can also say, I mean, I know Senator Schumer, I like the man personally, but let's face it, he's also dealing with a very specific ethnic contingent in New York.
And their very large five-letter lobbying arm.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. We won't even say what it is. People know what it is.
Yeah.
World War II reparations. I'm at the United Nations right as we're speaking, and this is fascinating. It is Greece is asking for reparations. They want $303 billion U.S. dollars. In 1960, Germany did pay 115 Deutschmarks, whatever that translates to right now. An Italian court recently, in the last 2 years, that reparations were basically water under the bridge. Greece is saying they were forced to give money in the form of a loan to the Nazi government. So this is the way Greece is trying to get itself out of the mess it's in.
Yeah, what do you think the chances are that that'll work? I know that the Germans have already said, you know, we already paid that. This is a non-issue. But, you know, Greece is basically saying to Germany,
not get anything, honestly.
You don't think they're going to get anything?
I think they're, you know, particularly because they've gotten so much help from Europe in terms of their financial situation anyway.
The flip side of that, though, is that Europe put them in that situation.
Well, they did put them in that situation. I mean, it's a mess over there. And but I don't see Greece getting any reparations money.
Yeah.
Now, maybe they're going to get some help from some of the other countries. That might be a possibility.
I would be astonished.
Money from Germany?
I would be astonished if they got reparations money from Germany. And Germany's going to resist this, not just because it's Greece, but because it could open a whole spigot of other claims. On the other hand, if Greece makes this argument and says, we really believe this is a strong argument, this is a legal argument, therefore we're not going to repay you this money, we're going to withhold that money, that might provide a rationale for defaulting that's not called a default.
That's very interesting, and that would be and you see, I think that's why they're doing this at this point, so they don't go into
default. Yeah, this is the third or fourth move forward in the chess game.
Yes. Senator Ron Paul formalized his bid for president today. I'm sure you've been talking about it.
Rand Paul.
His folks are making a very big pitch that he's a doctor. His website is Dr. Paul, not Senator Paul. He is talking about helping with 100 eye surgeries in Guatemala last year. His pitch is defeat the Washington machine, unleash the American dream. He says he's going after term limits, national debt, NSA surveillance, and special interest in the Washington machine.
Is he using a bong as his logo for his bumper stickers with Aqua Buddha?
I have no idea, but that would be great, huh? But, you know, he's moving. His issues on gay marriage are not good anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, he's really moved from libertarian to try and get in.
He's just a hustler. He's just another hustler.
Right. See, you know, I always say a senator gets elected, they look in the mirror, and they see the next president of the United States.
Yeah, it seems.
Okay, a couple other interesting things. The United Nations today said they're overwhelmed by Yemen and not getting the medical assistance they need in Yemen. And also, Amalakal, which is in Upper Nile State in South Sudan, is streaming refugees. Now, I'm going to be going there tomorrow, so I'll have much to say. The UN says they're witnessing a big movement, and 5,000 people in the last 48 hours have asked for help for shelter. There's a very interesting article in the Nation about what is really going on in Africa, not just in South Sudan, although it has a picture of Salva Kiir and the premier of China, but it's really talking about this is essentially proxy wars, et cetera, and I think that's where we really also need to be focusing.
Yeah, good point.
There's a lot going on, obviously, in Africa. Also, Russia is inviting world leaders to take to come to the anniversary of the victory in Europe. As you know, 70th anniversary. There's going to be a parade on May 9th. Not a lot of takers so far, but not sure what exactly they're going to be doing. I'm sure you might be covering that through your RT show, but this should be very interesting. I'm encouraging Luke Vargas, our UN reporter, to go to that.
Oh, that should be interesting. Yeah. I mean, Russia lost the largest number of civilians. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. I have been watching this story about Rolling Stone publishing the story of Jackie being raped at the University of Virginia at the frat house. It's the story itself. I read the story and I thought, you know, it was almost pornographic in how explicit it was. But if it was true, I think it's important for those kind of details to be there in a story like that. I was rather startled when I heard one commentator say that he had read the story four times. I thought, wow, I guess maybe it was porn. I read it once and thought, oh, my God, this is terrible. I mean, this and it's believable. And anybody who's been to college or not, I mean, knows that things like this happen and that the statistics, which are probably very low. In other words, they're probably not accurate in that they don't tell how bad things are. The statistics are that a young woman going to college, a freshman in college, over the course of the next 4 years, has a 20% chance, a 1 in 5 chance of being raped on campus. And the odds that the person who rapes her, the odds are highest that, A, it'll be somebody she knows. This isn't about, you know, the weird guy skulking around with a Bugs Bunny mask on or something. This, you know, that it'll be, you know, an acquaintance or a date, number one. And number two, that if it's a frat boy, he's 300% more likely to commit rape than if not, at least according to the statistics that I saw being presented yesterday by Crystal Ball over on MSNBC. And I trust her sources and her journalism. So that said, I mean, there's this very real reality that rape is happening on campuses across the United States, and that at the University of Virginia, for example, and others, I mean, there's been a bunch of these, and these stories are getting over, you know, repeated over and over again. These colleges are not at all reluctant to kick people out for cheating, for violating the honor code, for bringing disrepute on the school. But for violating a woman's body, for rape, no. I mean, many of these colleges haven't kicked anybody out for rape in decades. So now comes Rolling Stone saying, oops, you know, this story not only doesn't kind of hold together, that there wasn't a frat party that night, that Jackie was saying that there was, and that some of the people that she said were involved were saying, no, we weren't involved, and all this kind of thing. They handed it over to this fellow at the Columbia Journalism Review who was not paid and was given total carte blanche, and Rolling Stone said, we will publish your results, whatever they are. And they are. They are publishing them. They said, figure out, you know, get to the bottom of this. And he did, and essentially what he's saying is that, you know, and he and his team of forensic journalistic pathologists or whatever they would be called, concluded that there was no incident at all that the woman made the story up. Now, that surprised me, because a rape is an insanely traumatic experience. And when people are traumatized, it's not only not uncommon, it is almost normal for them to jumble in their brains the details of the trauma. So my assumption was, okay, if it turns out that you know, Thursday, March 16th, or whatever the day was, that she said that she was raped at a frat party, that there was no frat party in the frat house that day, she was probably a week off. That was my assumption. That, you know, probably it had happened the previous week or the previous month or the previous day or so. You know, that she got some details wrong. But the Columbia Journalism Review has concluded, and as has Rolling Stone, apparently, that basically this reporter got punked. You know, got sold a story or got told a story that she very much wanted to share with others for the very legitimate reason of highlighting and publicizing the problem, the very real problem of rape on campus. And so now we're stuck with this situation where there's a few things that have come out of this, and it's a very mixed bag. Number one, we're having a national conversation about rape on college campuses, which is a good thing. Fraternities are being examined in ways that they haven't been since the 60s, frankly. I mean, there's an anti-fraternity backlash, you know, back in the 60s that I remember. I mean, you know, I've never been in a fraternity, and in fact, I've never even been close friends, to the best of my knowledge, with somebody who was, certainly not when I was going to school, which wasn't that long a period of time. It was less than a year. But so in any case, I can't pretend to be an expert on frat culture or Greek culture or whatever they call it. But fraternities are being examined more carefully. The issues around what is, you know, when is no, what's consensual, all that kind of stuff, those things are coming to the fore. That's a healthy thing. On the other hand, in part as a consequence of this article, and in part for other reasons, well, for example, Charles Blow is writing about this in today's New York Times in the opinion page. And the headline is, Did Rolling Stone Hurt the Quest for Justice? And he cites Kevin Williamson, who wrote a National Review. Now, the National Review, I believe, is a conservative, I think that's William F. Buckley's publication, conservative, kind of mainstream conservative publication. The headline was, The Rape Epidemic is a Fiction. And similarly, the Washington Post fact checker said that, you know, talking about the frequency of rape, that as an interesting article from the University of Minnesota Duluth newspaper makes clear, sexual violence is too rarely reported, so the White House should be applauded for calling attention to this issue. But then he gets to Fox News. A Fox News host last month even suggested that the Rolling Stone story was evidence that there is a war happening on boys in these college campuses. Really? Of course, it's Fox News. And then the author of the Rolling Stone article, she's come out and she's said, I hope that my mistakes in reporting this story do not silence the voices of victims that need to be heard. And then Charles Blow goes on to talk about, and there's been a lot of hand-wringing is the wrong word, navel-gazing kind of, you know, introspection about things like, you know, what's real and what isn't, what are the... Excuse me, sneezed. What are the real issues? You know, for example, the attorney general, our African-American attorney general, working for our African-American president, investigated the Michael Brown incident in Ferguson and concluded that Michael Brown was probably actually behaving poorly, shall we say. It was, you know, got in an altercation with Officer Wilson. Now, that blows up the storyline of hands up, don't shoot. My guess is the reality, the truth is probably somewhere in between the two. But it's almost like my guess doesn't matter. We end up with these stories in our culture that become iconic and therefore become lessons for us. And I think that those lessons are actually really important, even when they're not factual in every detail. Because they're lessons about things that actually are happening, even if this particular example isn't the very best example. So anyhow, I wanted to toss that out. I'm curious your thoughts on it. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Did this Rolling Stone piece hurt the quest for justice, as Charles Blow asks? Or did it inadvertently raise the issue in a good way? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, Tom still wants to talk about veganism in Madison, Florida. Hey, Tom, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind?
Yes, Tom, you are my mentor, Tom Hartman.
Well, thank you.
I would take issue with the veganism, not to say that it's not good, but I wanted to make the point that animals are protein concentrators, and also they make available protein that would not otherwise be made available. Example, I say you have a T-bone steak, right?
Mm-hmm.
It might have required 100, 200 pounds of hay to get there to make that T-bone steak. Well,
right.
First of all, we couldn't have eaten the 200 pounds of hay because our stomachs cannot convert it to a form that our bodies can deal with. So...
Your argument, Tom, is predicated.
Protein is the most important, since it goes into most every important functional molecule in our body. Of course, fats and carbohydrates are important too. But bottom line,
Tom,
is that once
Tom,
again, that,
Tom, you're,
especially
you're,
in our very active lives, we don't have the time to eat. Pounds and
okay,
pounds.
Tom, your argument is predicated on the assumption that we need to be getting protein. Tom, can you hear me?
We can get our lives,
Tom, we're gonna,
our lives by eating the protein. Now,
yeah.
There are going to be, just because everything, you know, there's...
No, I got that's fine. Tom, I really want to respond to what you're saying. And I keep talking, and I'm guessing you've got one of those phones where you can't hear the person when they're talking back at you. So I'm going to put you on hold for a minute. Your predicating assumption is wrong. It's the predicating assumption that Frances Morlepay based her book Diet for a Small Planet on back in the 1970s. And that is that we need protein and we need a certain balance of protein in order to be healthy. And that the only way to get that is to by being careful about our diet. And within a year or so of the publication of that book, Diet for a Small Planet, which talked about, okay, you need, tryptophan and tyrosine or whatever. You know, you need a couple of amino acids to combine together to make a whole protein. And so you take rice and you take beans, and one's deficient in one, the other's deficient in the other. But between the two of them, they got everything you need for a protein, and you eat them together. That was her strategy. There was a paper published about a year later by a scientist by the name of G. Nasser, titled Amino Acid Homeostasis in the Gut Lumen of Mammals. He put tubes into the stomachs of dogs and measured the amino acid levels and fed them diets that were completely deficient in one specific amino acid. Very different ones, but one specific amino acid, one of the so-called essential ones, the ones that your body doesn't produce. And what did he find? There was no shortage of, they could not induce a shortage of amino acids. And therefore, they could not induce a shortage of protein in that dog. Because your body is constantly recycling your entire body. It's breaking it down, sending it to the liver. It gets broken down to amino acids, dumped into the small intestine, and reabsorbed. And so there's always the full spectrum of amino acids that you need in order for your body to make protein. And in fact, if you go to that nutritionfacts.org site, you will see where Dr. Greger, you can Google this very easily or read it. You know, the vegans actually have higher levels of albumin, which is the principal protein circulating in our blood, higher levels of protein in their blood than meat eaters do. So, respectfully, Tom, and now I've talked through the whole thing, so, Tom, I'm sorry. Thank you for calling. We'll have to continue the conversation another time. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past this. Welcome back, Tom Hartman, here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. And Michael in Boulder, Colorado. Hey, Michael, you want to talk about fraternities?
Yes. Hi, Tom. You mentioned there about the 60s and all. I'm originally from New York. And when I was in high school, I was a rather gifted track guy, and also played baseball. I played all the sports, but my two main sports were baseball and track. When I applied to CCNY, the City College of New York, at that time they had fraternities. So somehow they found out that I was a kind of a star athlete coming out of high school. So one of the fraternities approached me and, you know, hey, you can, you know, we have a brownstone here. You can live there and all, and you know, it's going to be great. You'll make connections in the future. But I found out very quickly that they were recruiting the athlete and not the person. And me being part Latin American, okay, they were trying to solve, I think, a problem of maybe let's get a token minority in there. The second day of orientation, I told them to take a hike.
Yeah.
And shortly thereafter, the State University and the City College of New York basically disbanded the fraternities because there was a lot of drinking, a lot of other things that go along with drinking and stuff. And as social organizations, even at that time, I really didn't see what they did because everybody that was in the fraternity there, with the exception of me and one other recruit who happened to be an African-American athlete, were white and somewhat privileged.
Yeah.
So I know you probably saw some of the same things on your end. We're close to the same age, being in Michigan, which probably had much bigger fraternities than where I grew up in New York State, New York City.
Yeah.
So I don't like them. My kids went to public universities here that had fraternities, and when they said, "Dad, do you think I should play?" I said, "No. You can make your connections on your own, and what your diploma says when you walk, you know, off that stage when you graduate, that's what's going to open up the doors for you, rather than some fraternity brother, you know, who will lead you to somebody and, you know, hey, yeah, just give them the handshake."
Yeah, so my dad was never in a fraternity. Nobody ever made that pitch to me. I was definitely not recruited. My mom, however, who went to Michigan State and graduated, in fact, magna cum laude in English, which is why I'm obsessive about grammar and punctuation. My mom went to a sorority. Now, this was in the 1940s. She started going to college at the very tail end of World War II, and graduated. I forget the year, but I think it was like 47, 48, something like that. But and she came from a family that had virtually no money at all. I mean, you know, her father died when she was 13. Her mother was the city clerk for the city of Charlevoix, and just, you know, a single mother on a civil servant's salary. And my mom worked her way through college, washing and propping airplanes out at the Lansing Airport through the school year, and as a lifeguard in Charlevoix during the summer. But she joined a sorority because, A, it was less expensive living. B, it was safe. It was considered a safe place to be on campus, because Charlevoix was a long way from Lansing. And C, and she was right up front about this with me, one of the reasons that women went to college in the 1940s was to meet eligible men who would be good providers, and college graduates would probably be better than people who weren't. You know, the story that I understand from, you know, the stories that I heard about fraternities and sororities when I was a kid from my parents is that basically the fraternities were all about, not so much meeting, you know, a sorority girl that you're going to marry, but rather meeting other guys who came from wealthy, privileged families and would become the captains of industry who might bring you in as a junior vice president at IBM someday when they're the CEO or something. And that was a world that I had no interest in anyway. You know, it's kind of like an extension of white privilege on steroids, you know.
Yes. Yes, I definitely agree with you, because what I saw, you know, me being a member of that fraternity, was that I was going to start off at least first year as basically a busboy running around. And, you know, you're a pledge and you understand that there is a pecking order. But I saw beyond that, because I really felt that there was a hypocrisy. Also, the Vietnam War was on at that time.
Yep.
And I had I had a lot of mixed feelings. I went into the military shortly after this experience, basically, and I lived through that experience. And the thing was that I saw these guys, they were deferred, and they were the first ones to go down. And if there was an anti-war demonstration down at the UN or in Central Park or something, they went down there basically looking to beat people up.
Well, and that was the other thing. That was one of the reasons why I was not fraternity friendly when I was in college. We used to hang out, a lot of the SDS crowd hung out at the Student Union at Michigan State University. And Louise and I used to, we spent probably thousands of hours there in aggregate over a couple of years. And it's where a lot of the anti-war movement came, and a lot of other, you know, good stuff came out of that. And we'd sit around and play a lot of pinochle. But and debate with George Fish and Mike Price, you know, Marxist dialectics and things. It was fascinating stuff.
Right.
But the frat boys used to come in and tease us because we all had long hair and, you know, wore jeans and things, and, you know, make smart ass remarks. And I mean, there was clearly this sense among at least some of the people in some of the fraternities at MSU in the 60s that they were the chosen few and the rest of us were the riffraff. I don't know how it is now. And it would be really interesting to hear from people who are, you know, in or recent members of or have had contact with fraternities or sororities now on campus. And to what extent that may be feeding into or maybe even might be a solution to the problem of rape culture on campus. I mean, the way my mom never used the word rape, but, you know, she talked about the sorority house being the place where she was safe. And I'm pretty sure that's what she was talking about. And so, you know, did sororities evolve in response to the threat of predatory fraternities? God only knows. Michael, thank you for the call. Interesting, thought-provoking stuff. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
The other thing I think that is actually good about this whole Rolling Stone thing is that the press is examining itself. And that's something that's always a help. This is very interesting. Saw this yesterday, actually Sunday, on Democratic Underground by Daman Sarajaya. But it came from Kansas.com, which is the Wichita State University newspaper. And actually, I'm not sure which newspaper it is, but it's here it is. Here's the link. The headline on the Democratic Underground Post from Sunday, April 5th, is a WSU statistician sues seeking Kansas voting machine paper tapes. This is fascinating stuff. I guarantee you, Brad Friedman, bradblog.com, has got to be all over this, although I haven't looked at his website to see. I'll bet he is. A statistician at Wichita State University, this is in Kansas, WSU, is seeing the same unexplained skew for Republican candidates in Kansas's last election as Francois Choquette and James Johnson found in 2008 and 2012. The pattern is bizarrely consistent. As the size of the precinct increases, the skew from Democratic to Republican vote increases. This would be the logical effect of a vote-flipping algorithm. In other words, somebody has corrupted, hacked, virus-infected, malwared, whatever, the voting machines in Kansas. For instance, if a small precinct flipped too many votes, it might end up with a zero or negative vote total, which would be proof positive of election fraud. Much less dangerous is flipping more votes in districts with more votes cast. Beth Clarkson, chief statistician for the university's National Institute for Aviation Research, filed the open records lawsuit in Sedgwick County District Court as part of her personal quest to find an answer to this unexplained pattern. She's seeking paper tapes from electronic voting machines in an effort to explain statistical anomalies favoring Republicans in counts coming from large precincts across the country. Here's where it gets really interesting. The biggest cities in the state, Kansas City, Kansas, Lawrence, and Wichita, have bigger precincts and normally vote more Democratic. Big cities tend to be Democratic. But what has happened in Kansas is that as these cities grow, they are voting more and more Republican. And she's saying, well, this doesn't make any sense. Now, maybe it does make sense. I mean, maybe it's just, and maybe it's the Fox News effect. Maybe it's right-wing talk radio in these cities. Every single one of these cities has at least one right-wing talk radio station and no progressive radio talk stations. The people who own the media in this country really, really want a right-wing pro-corporate message out there and are not so fond of, you know, things like what I have to say. Clarkson, a certified quality engineer with a PhD in statistics, says she has analyzed election returns in Kansas and elsewhere over several elections that indicate a statistically significant pattern where the percentage of Republican votes increases the larger the size of the precinct. Very interesting. You know, the official kind of Democratic Party position is don't talk about voting machines. People won't trust them. They won't go to vote. I think we need to be talking about voting machines. I really do. And it's not that I'm, you know, that I have any certainty or proof that something nefarious is going on, but there has never been a time in the history of this country when somebody wasn't trying to mess with the vote. You know, it just comes along with it. And it's like free food on a cruise, right? It just, you know, the two go together. Voting, ballot boxes, hey, let's stuff them. You know, that kind of thing. So, The Guardian, Trevor Tim. This is in the Saturday Guardian, but it's worth mentioning. A small part of the Middle East, well, the headline says basically the whole thing. This, again, keep in mind, this is a UK newspaper. Republicans have no interest in peace. The Iran talks proved that. That's the headline. A small part of the Middle East may soon be off limits to U.S. bombing and killing, so naturally Republicans and their neocon allies are furious. Senator Mark Kirk kicked things off by quickly proving Godwin's law and absurdly declaring that Neville Chamberlain got a better deal from Adolf Hitler. Netanyahu, even his own intelligence services, don't agree with him. All 16 U.S. intelligence agencies have concluded that Iran actually abandoned its active nuclear weapons program in 2003. The U.S. has known this since at least 2007, when a classified national intelligence estimate, which undercut George W. Bush's burgeoning Iran war talk, was leaked to the media. So we've known since 2007 that the Iranians haven't been trying to build a bomb since 2003. according to all 16 U.S. intelligence agencies. That hasn't stopped senators like Democrat Robert Menendez from repeatedly referring to Iran's illicit nuclear weapons program, and former U.N. ambassador and cartoonish war fanatic John Bolton is running a much-mocked Twitter advertising campaign condemning a deal before anyone has had a chance to read it. Republican de facto presidential candidates tried to outdo each other for who could condemn the deal in more gratuitous terms, despite probably not having the first clue about what it entails. And then Trevor Tim writes, "This is no surprise, given that in 2008, all the Republican nominees were in agreement that the U.S. should potentially drop nuclear bombs to stop Iran's non-existent nuclear bomb program. So the bar was pretty high." Right. Even Jeb, I'm my own man, Bush, denounced the framework, though I guess that probably shouldn't be a surprise since his advisors are full of George W. Bush-era war architects. Amazing. Now, and then it gets really interesting. He says, when neocons like Bolton come out of the woodwork to denounce the chance for peace with Iran, it's always amusing to remember the people most responsible for helping Iran start their nuclear program. Who were those two people? Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld. They pushed Gerry Ford to sign a deal to sell Iran nuclear material in 1976, but somehow that never gets brought up on Fox News when they're calling Iran the devil, writes Trevor Tim in The Guardian. Yeah, Republicans have no interest in peace. This is all about 2016. This is, frankly, in my mind, this is all about making sure that the White House is taken by a Republican, because in a year and a half, you are going to have three members of the Supreme Court over 80 years old, and Breyer is going to be nearly 80, and you know, a fifth member is in his late 70s. So you've got at least three, probably four, maybe five Supreme Court justices who will be appointed by the next president. And this is why Republicans are fighting so hard, in large part. I mean, there's a whole bunch of reasons why they are, but this is why they're viewing 2016 as a potentially apocalyptic election if the Democrats win, or as the potential end point, the absolute turning point, their final orgasmic opportunity to destroy the New Deal and the Great Society using the Supreme Court. I mean, Clarence Thomas has already basically said he agrees with the Lochner Court back in the 1920s. You know, it's not the business of the federal government to involve itself in things like child labor laws. It should be up to the states. Lunch counters, who can eat at the lunch counter? It should be up to the states. Pretty consequential stuff. Bob in Sherman Oaks, California. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I called you when you were discussing cost of health care, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing I'd like to say, though, anybody in Chicago who's listening to the radio when it's over, probably it's over there in Chicago pretty soon, go do what you have to for Chuy Garcia.
Well, not just the mayors. There's some very consequential judicial races, and there's a ballot measure on the ballot that would make the judicial races less political, and those are all very important things.
Yeah. Well, just to finish that up, just that the $30 million that Rahm Emanuel had to the $5 million that Chuy Garcia had, who had to work out of a slum apartment because none of the real estate people would rent him the headquarters. I mean, Rahm Emanuel is more scary to me than the Republicans, because if we have that wing of the Democratic Party retaining power, especially over a city like Chicago that is probably represents what I would call middle America in the old days of manufacturing,
yeah,
and that now, as you were saying, as the people move back into the cities from the suburbs, the billionaire's best friend, Rahm Emanuel in Chicago, is selling our education system to Bill Gates and other billionaires. That's just one. So getting on to, if you don't mind, like getting on to Medicare.
We have a half a minute.
Everybody think it's single payer, because you talked about this when I first called Tom. Mm-hmm. Unbeknownst, I'm 76, and unbeknownst to most people, if you don't take out a private plan, usually it's Plan F right now, and those on Medicare will recognize that, for which costs me, it's age 76, $300 a month, plus Part D for pharmacy, plus the copays, approximately $500 a month for this so-called government program, all going to it. You will not be covered. There's a substitute teacher that works, which is my job, and she's 81 years old and has to work, even though she has a teacher's pension, because her husband is getting $100,000 a year in dialysis that's not covered.
Wow.
Either Medicare or her school.
Bob, amazing story. Thank
you
for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archive.
15 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back. And welcome back as I reboot my call screen software here. And it seems to be working. Hey, how about that? Bill, watching Free Speech TV in Selby, South Dakota. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I'm going to back up a little bit here and get back on the subject of raising beef.
Okay.
I'm a certified organic farmer and rancher here, so not that I'm an expert, but I'd like to share a few things with you. You criticize, and I agree with you, corporate grain-based confinement system of animal production. Mm-hmm. It is obscene. But there's a lot of differences between that and the grass-based method. I know farmers and ranchers here who have done this, and it works. They have rotationally grazed pastures and cropland and increased their organic matter from the typical 1.5%, 2.5% up to 4%, 5%, even 8%. And that's a tremendous amount of carbon sequestered.
You're right.
If you're worried about global warming.
You're
and,
right.
They've also increased their production. And we criticize the fossil fuel inputs in raising beef. These fellows, it's almost negligible. They don't feed any grain. A lot of them don't feed any hay. So other than a little gas in their four-wheeler, when they move fence, it's really a low input.
Right.
And also the water input, these fellows have increased their water retention and on their land to the point where this one fellow had an 8-inch downpour and there was no runoff. The water percolates, soaks in, grows plant material, recharges the water table, recharges the prairie potholes. You know, so these are all good things.
Mm-hmm.
And in this area, there's also a tremendous amount of grassland that's being converted to cropland. And of course, here and all around the country, it's mostly GMO corn and beans,
right,
which is not a good thing either. So I just wanted to point these things out. You know, that there are good ways to raise beef also, and that's aside from the debate about the
I agree, and separating that from the diet. And again, maybe I am a fanatic. I don't think of myself as a fanatic on this issue. I'm sure over the years I've eaten in a lot of restaurants that I've been served soup stock that had beef stock in it or something like that. I don't go out of my way to drill waiters and harass, you know, chefs and things and find out. Although increasingly now, especially over the last decade, restaurants will tell you, you know, what is and what isn't. But good point, yeah. Bill. There are healthy ways.
Yeah. I don't criticize you for being a vegetarian. It's not my choice. But and you maybe know more about this than I do. But a little bit ago, you were debating your fellow debater, and my wife was watching, and she says, your complexion is rather orange and his is rather pink. And she said something about beta carotene.
Yeah.
Anything about that?
The orange is probably because I'm wearing a yellow shirt. And you know, it's this thing. There's this thing called white balance, color balance, that you have to calibrate your cameras every day. You hold a white screen up and you calibrate the camera and adjust for the lights and all this kind of stuff. And Jim, our video guy, his wife had a baby, a preemie. And he's been home for a couple of weeks on sick leave or on maternity leave, whatever you want to call it. And so we haven't color balanced our cameras in a week and a half. So heaven only knows, maybe 2 weeks. I have no idea what color my skin is right now on TV. And then, you know,
you look kind of orange. You look almost like John Boehner.
Oh, really? Oh, man. Okay. Yeah. Thanks, Bill, I think. Thanks for the call. It's good to know. It's good to know. Appreciate it. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Dan in Simpsonville, South Carolina. Dan, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Oh, great. My software isn't responding, but it looks like I still have Bill on the line. But I clicked your button, and there you are. So, hey, Dan, what's up?
Well, you know, I'm down here in Greenville, and Clemson's not far away, and you guys were talking about the fraternities. And I'll be honest, I don't agree with you much. I love your show, but I agree with shedding light on this whole fraternity thing, and not just the rape stuff, but everything that goes on. Back in September, there was a boy, a new pledge, who the older kids in the fraternity asked them to bring food for their meeting the next day. Well, the kid didn't have enough money. They told them that, and they said, you better bring it. Well, when he showed up the next day without the food, they took everybody out on a run in the dark. And there's this bridge that they used to jump off of during the day. Well, when they got over the bridge, they threw this kid over. And the water was not deep enough, and the kid got hurt very badly.
Mm.
And they all freaked out, and they took off. And they didn't tell anybody for 8 hours. In the meantime, the boy died.
Oh, my.
And the boys lied about it. They didn't even admit to doing that. Well, the investigation happened. It's coming out this spring that they're texting each other, they're emailing each other about, you know, don't tell anybody, nobody will know, and all that stuff. And now it's all coming out that there were three boys that really kind of did it. Now, they didn't do it on purpose. It was an accident. But the kid may have been saved if they had just gone down there and helped them.
Yeah.
But that kind of thing happens because the kid didn't have enough money to buy breakfast for the older kids in the fraternity.
Wow.
Which is an unbelievable shame.
Yeah.
So that stuff is going on with with a whole bunch of different things, and I think the more sunlight that's on that, the better.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. My caller software has just completely blown up. I'm going to thanks a lot for the call, and if you can hang up on your end, I can't hang you up on this end. I'd appreciate it. I'm gonna see if maybe my old Telos software will come up. Hey, it does. How about that? So let's see if I can put a caller on the air. Hey, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Great. Tell me your name and where you're calling from.
Last caller from New Orleans.
Okay. What's up?
Yeah. I was calling, going back to last week. You had a doctor on there talking about the FAA because he works with them. He made a comment that the FAA is starting to allow pilots to fly with some of these medications that help with depression. That is completely false because I just had to go through hell to get my medical back. Because I was taking one of these medications, and by accident, my doctor could not find it on the FAA website's list of a non-usable medication.
Right, as a physician. I think the point that Peter Bregan was making was that many of the international airlines don't test for that. Although maybe he said U.S. ones don't. My understanding has always been that the U.S. airlines are doing random drug tests. And that to
now,
get...
I got my commercial certificate. And I'm only practicing private because I make more money doing what I do now than flying for commercial.
Uh-huh.
But I had to go I live here in New Orleans. I had to go to Houston to take my medical physical because the doctor there is kind of like a FAA medical examiner along with kind of like a lawyer you need. It took me close to 4 years to finally get everything cleared up.
Wow.
I mean, it was that long. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a private pilot also. I'm a private pilot also, and although it's been decades since I've had a medical, so I can't fly right now. But I still have a valid license, but I don't, I don't have a certificate.
All the phone, all this new stuff.
Yeah.
All the new equipment that we have, it is great.
Oh, I know. It's yeah, go ahead.
Flying with the iPad, using ForeFlight, it's a lot easier. Everything's great. But like I said, it's just a lot of things they over... I'm saying it being overly sensitive, but then also, like somebody told me, the good have to suffer for the bad.
Yeah.
You know, bad people done things with planes, so the good have to suffer with it.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah.
And I understand that. But.
Got it. Okay, thanks a lot for the call, and, excellent points. And as far as I know, you're absolutely right. Let's see here. Hey, you're on the air. I can't see a name or a city. Your name? Can you hear me?
Hello?
Yeah, that's you. What's your name?
Oh, my name is Chuck.
I'm hey, Chuck.
I'm from Uzbekistan.
Okay.
You might call it Wyoming.
Okay.
back in the mid-80s, I worked in a hospital. I would read the medical journals.
Uh-huh.
And one of them had a diet that scientists did a study to decide what people should eat based on comparing our digestive tract to those of other great apes.
Right.
And the conclusion was that human beings need 1/4 pound of meat a week.
That's probably, you know, evolutionarily, that makes a lot of sense. That would be consistent with our being, you know, basically scavengers and gatherers and occasional hunters. But, yeah, that would make a lot of sense.
Yeah. The diet that comes closest to it was traditional Chinese.
Yeah, which is very low in protein. I think, you know, my understanding is that most indigenous cultures eat around 18% protein in their diet, but it's not anywhere near that percentage of it from meat, you know. So it's, you know, how we get our protein, there's a variety of ways to get our protein. And our body manufactures protein, of course, out of free amino acids. So it's pretty straightforward stuff. Okay. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. We have how much time left? 30 seconds. So that's, you know, not, oh, yeah, okay. Well, just see if somebody's got a quick comment to make. Hey, you're on the air.
This is RW in Chattanooga. Can you hear me?
Hey, RW. Yeah, quick comment.
Call Congress because the Democrats are about to give Corker a veto-proof majority on his Iran bill. And we need to call Congress and tell them not to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. Already.
I agree. And I'd start by calling Chuck Schumer's office. Yep, I agree. Thank you very much for the call. Great to hear from you. And my apologies for the phone screw up here in the last little bit. But we will be back tomorrow and we'll get everything working. Don't you worry. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It actually does require all of us to show up. So if you're in Chicago, get out and vote. And for whomever you may vote for. And if you're anywhere else in the country, please get involved. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.